This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese is editing a new series of books that is republishing several classics about movies. One of them is Memo from David O. Selznick, which was first published in 1972. Selznick was the producer of such films as Gone with the Wind, The Four Feathers, Dinner at Eight, David Copperfield, Anna Karenina, A Tale of Two Cities, Made for Each Other, Rebecca, Spellbound, Duel in the Sun, and The Third Man. Selznick handled much of his communications with stars and directors through memos, and those memos are very revealing of Hollywood in the era of the studio system. The book was edited by Rudy Belmer, who joined us a few months ago to talk about the making of King Kong. We invited him back to discuss Selznick. One of the stars that David O. Selznick discovered was Ingrid Bergman. He was responsible for launching her career in America after she had already started making movies in her native Sweden.
That's correct.
And he felt very strongly that she had the potential to be beautiful on screen, but you had to be really careful the way you shot her, because if you shot her from the wrong angle, she wouldn't look beautiful. He wrote, the difference in her photography is the difference between great beauty and a complete lack of beauty. In fact, would you read an excerpt of the June 22nd, 1939 memo that he wrote about the importance of using the correct angles for photographing her?
Yes. Now, he's writing a memo in this case to the director of the film, Gregory Radoff, with a copy to Greg Toland, who was the cinematographer on the film. And this is just an excerpt. It's, once again, not a brief memo. But he says, the Toland tests of Miss Bergman prove indubitably what we have been saying since before the picture started, that more than with any other girl that I know of in pictures, the difference between a great photographic beauty and an ordinary girl with Miss Bergman lies in proper photography of her, and that this in turn depends not simply on avoiding the bad side of her face, keeping her head down as much as possible, giving her the proper hairdress, and not to make her look too big, and even more importantly, but for the same reason, avoiding low cameras on her, as well as being careful to build people who work with her, such as Leslie Howard and Edna Best, as well, of course, as the children beside whom she looks titanic if the camera work isn't carefully studied. But more important of all, on shading her face and invariably going for effect lightings on her. This means that there should not be a single sequence of the picture that is not staged for real effect lighting, whether it be morning, afternoon, or night, and so forth and so on.
How much do you think that advice was followed in her
life? Oh, it was followed. Ingrid Bergman was a fairly large woman. And, of course, he was concerned that, you know, that her leading men would look smaller than she. And also, he wanted to give her a fresh quality. This was the time, as you know, of the plucked eyebrows and the heavy makeup and, you know, the glamorization process, which he did not want to use on Ingrid Bergman. He thought that she was particularly effective with a scrubbed look. Now, this was, again, contrary to current practice at that time. You know, glamour was the keynote. But he felt that she would come off best in a more natural state. So he had to fight this with the makeup people and with the hairdressers and with the cameramen. Not fight it, but insist upon going this route, which, of course, worked out very well. I mean, we know how Ingrid Bergman photographed, and it was part of what made her certainly a star for the American public.
Selznick and Ingrid Bergman had a falling out. I mean, he discovered her in America and made her a star. What was their falling out about?
Well, the falling out, she had been under contract to him for quite some time, and he was loaning her out, which was standard practice at the time, and of course, realizing a profit on the loan out that she wasn't getting. But that was also standard practice. And after several years, she wanted to leave Selznick and go on and do other things. And there was discussions about who was going to pay what, you know, to get out of the contract. So Selznick, who was quite honestly very unhappy about this for a variety of reasons, because Ingrid Bergman was still a very, very big commodity that he had on his list. And he wrote a letter as though it was written by Ingrid Bergman to David Selznick, in which she recounted, Selznick recounted, in her words, all of the things that he had done for her since she arrived from Sweden, that made the point of what he had done and what she had wanted to do that he dissuaded her from doing, and what he had been able to arrange for her to do in pictures. In any case, the bottom line is, this was a letter that he hoped might change her mind. Unfortunately, it didn't, but it's a very interesting letter.
Would you read a few lines from this 1947 letter that Selznick writes in the voice of Ingrid Bergman?
Yes, this is, once again, a long letter, but one part of it here. This is in the middle of it all. He says, "Unfortunately for you," this, of course, is supposedly Ingrid Bergman talking, "when I returned from Europe and had everything that I wanted, I forgot all about my promises and statements through the years. I forgot everything you had done for me. I forgot my promises and even my letter. And I demanded payment for the picture, which I asked you to give up, and which you had given up, and which could have been one of the subjects listed above, on which you would, of course, have made a great deal of money, as well as absorbed your overhead, which was idle largely as a result of not making a picture, my not making a picture. It is true that I entertained the troops on my own insistent desire to do so, but I didn't see, and still don't see, why you shouldn't pay me $60,000 for having done so."
Yeah, and it goes on and on.
It goes on and on, and it is this listing of all of the things, you know, and you had given me these directors, which you had insisted upon, and I was able to do this project, which I wanted to do, and you were able to work out the details, and blah, 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 and so forth and so on. So it makes a very good case for Mr. Selznick, quite obviously.
I think that his relationship with Ingrid Bergman early in her career and the way he paid such attention to how she was photographed and how she looked shows the attention that he took with his actresses. While he was making Rebecca with Joan Fontaine, he saw that the makeup men had tweezed her eyebrows, which really upset him. He hated tweezed eyebrows, and he wrote, "What can I do to get you makeup men to throw away your kits and your tweezers? The public is so far ahead of you all and is so sick of your makeup. You are all managing to contribute to the destruction of stars." And he was upset about the way Marlene Dietrich looked on one of her films. I'm going to ask you to read this excerpt of a 1936 memo about how Marlene Dietrich was looking. Tell us the context of the memo and read an excerpt for us.
Okay. Well, he made one picture with Marlene Dietrich, who was not under contract to Selznick. It was called The Garden of Allah, and it was photographed in Technicolor, which at that time, the three-color Technicolor was brand new. And, of course, Marlene Dietrich was an exotic glamour lady and had been portrayed that way and, of course, had extreme makeup and very careful photography and what have you. But he was a little concerned, even though he didn't want her to look like Ingrid Bergman with the fresh scrub look. He was a little concerned about the excess here. So he was writing to the director, Richard Boleslavsky, in 1936. And he says, "Surely a little reality can't do a great beauty any harm. Would you please speak to Marlena about the fact that her hair is getting so much attention and is being coiffed to such a degree that all reality is lost? Her hair is so well placed that at all times when the wind is blowing, for instance, or when Marlena is on a balcony or walking through the street, it remains perfectly smooth and unruffled. In fact, it's so well placed that it could be nothing but a wig. The extreme in ridiculousness is the scene in bed. No woman in the world has ever had her hair appear as Marlena's does in this scene, and the entire scene becomes practically unusable because everything's so exactly in place and the whole effect of a harassed and troubled woman is lost," etc., etc. And the hairdresser rushing in between takes to put each strand of her hair in play, you know. And so he was trying valiantly here to get a little naturalism into the exotica. He was not against glamour, certainly. And when it was appropriate, or not taken to extremes. But in the case of Joan Fontaine, which you brought up in Rebecca, Joan Fontaine was supposed to be a very plain, you know, ordinary, non-glamorous, totally non-glamorous character in this film. And, of course, he wanted to keep it that way. That was part of the charm of the piece.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rudy Belmer, and his 1972 book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been republished as one of the first books in a series edited by Martin Scorsese, and it's the Modern Library The Movies series. We'll talk more with Rudy Belmer about David O. Selznick's memos after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rudy Belmer, who has written extensively over the years about movies, and his 1972 book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been republished in a new film series edited by Martin Scorsese. And this book contains a lot of the memos that producer David O. Selznick wrote over the years to the people making movies with him. David O. Selznick is most famous for creating the movie Gone with the Wind and having quite a controlling hand in the movie's production. In the memos, he writes a lot about searching all over for an unknown actress to play Scarlett. Why was it so important to him to try to cast an unknown actress?
Well, of course, all of the top actresses at the time wanted to play Scarlett O'Hara. By then, the book had been a phenomenal publishing success, and it is a wonderful character. So the Bette Davises and the Loretta Youngs and virtually everyone in Hollywood was you know, ready to go and wanted to play this part. But he felt that people who had been stars for a while, let's take Bette Davis for an example, you know, they had already an image and they were associated with various characters and so on. He wanted to find somebody who was not known to the American public so that people would think of this person as Scarlett O'Hara, not as one of the stars portraying Scarlett O'Hara. He felt that it would enhance the portrayal if it was someone that didn't have that full laundry list of credits behind them. So that's why Vivian Leigh eventually came to play the part, because in America she was hardly known. She had done a few British films.
Now, he wasn't looking for an unknown for the part of Rhett Butler. He knew he wanted Clark Gable. In fact, he co-partnered with MGM, the studio that Gable was contracted to, so he could get Gable for the part. Why did he feel so strongly about him?
Well, he felt strongly about him because virtually everyone thought that Clark Gable was Rhett Butler. And I'm speaking of the reading public, which, of course, people that were reading this novel, you know, were in the millions. And there didn't seem to be any dispute. You know, there was no, well, there are four other people who... It was Clark Gable. There had been thoughts about, very early on, about Gary Cooper. There had been thoughts about Errol Flynn. But it was almost unanimous that everybody thought it has to be Gable. Well, of course, Gable was under contract to MGM. So the only way, as the time went by, that he could get Gable was to make a deal with MGM, not only to borrow Gable, but to let them distribute the film, put money in the film, and also own 50% of it. What a deal.
Selznick hired George Cukor to direct Gone with the Wind, and then fired him and hired Victor Fleming, who's also famous for directing The Wizard of Oz. And when he fired him, Selznick wrote, "We can no longer be sentimental about it. We are a business concern and not patrons of the arts." What insights do the memos by Selznick offer about why he got rid of Cukor?
Well, there are a lot of stories about that. There's nothing that blatantly says, "George, you're out of here." It was a combination of many factors. First of all, he was extremely nervous about this enterprise. This was going to be the biggest thing that he had ever attempted. There was a lot of money involved. He was uncertain. The script was still not right, and he was getting changes down on the set to Cukor every day, every hour. It was driving Cukor crazy. He had so many suggestions, and it was the first time that he actually spent a lot of time on the set second-guessing a director, which became a habit through the years after that. But up until that point, was not that way. There was uncertainty. There was uncertainty about interpretation. And finally, after a couple of weeks, it wasn't working. And I think both of them knew it. And that was that. Although Selznick was very careful to place George Cukor over at MGM to do the women, I mean, he had nothing against QCAR. He just felt that in this instance it wasn't working. So they shut down. And he took Fleming because Fleming and Gable were very, very close and had done several films together. And Fleming was a excellent director. He was top of the line. And he was just finishing up Wizard of Oz, believe it or not, and segued from The Wizard of Oz to Gone with the Wind and almost collapsed as Gone with the Wind was shooting. In fact, he did have to take a few weeks off since he was on the verge of collapse.
One of the things that's really famous about Gone with the Wind is the score by Max Steiner.
That's right.
Now, David O. Selznick nearly fired Max Steiner in part because Steiner wasn't writing quickly enough, and Selznick wanted Steiner to write from the script, whereas Steiner insisted on actually seeing footage before he composed. I'm wondering if you think that Selznick's control over everything was a blessing or a curse, or a blessing and a curse.
I think, Terry, what you just said at the end there, a blessing and a curse. Obviously, people didn't want to be controlled to the extent that Selznick wanted to control them. Now, Max Steiner had worked for Selznick ever since 1932, where they were both at RKO Radio Pictures, and Selznick was in charge of production. But, of course, Steiner was a workhorse, and Steiner, you know, was doing 9-10 pictures a year and so forth. And he had to squeeze in Gone with the Wind. Also, Steiner was not used to reading scripts. He wanted to sit down and look at the finished movie and then start scoring. That was the way he did it, because he felt that if you looked at a script and then started in, that the picture may evolve in a different manner. So why even bother with that? Let's see what the final result is, and I will be moved to compose to what I react to on the screen. So Selznick was concerned about this. Also, Selznick wanted to use, he was always a great fan of using classical music, and he wanted to use Southern music, of course, Stephen Foster and so forth, and the militaristic and the patriotic tunes of the day, all of which was fine, and which Steiner would have done anyway to a degree, because Steiner knew that you had to, you know, put in this material to give it the period flavor. But Selznick seemed to want to go even further than that, which Steiner reject it, because he felt that music that is identified and associated with something else, such as classical music, it detracts from what's on the screen, unless it's, you know, once again, a Southern tune or Dixie or Rally Round the Flag Boys or something where it's appropriate. So they would have discussions and arguments about that. And, of course, what ended up was a fine score. It was generally original from Steiner, with some of these interpolated pieces from the South.
You reprint a memo that Selznick wrote to Will Hayes during the making of Gone with the Wind about the line, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," which is, I guess, the most famous line from the movie. And the code, the production code, prevented him from using that line. The head of the office, Joe Breen, wouldn't give Selznick permission to use that line. So he wrote to Will Hayes, "It is my contention that this word, as used in the picture, is not an oath or a curse. The worst that could be said against it is that it is a vulgarism." Do you know what happened after that, how they fought it out?
They did fight it out, because it's hard to believe now, of course. But back in 1939, you could not use a curse word. And that famous line, "Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn," which Rhett says at the end of the film, he didn't want to use something that would soften that. And he felt the only way you could do it was to have it just that way. But they did shoot a protection reading, just in case they lost the battle, where he didn't say that. He said something like it, but he didn't say damn. But in any case, they finally gave in, because he had convinced them. He did all this research and the fact that it wasn't used in the fashion, blah, 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 blah. But you see, the Hayes office was concerned that if they did let it go, it would open up the floodgates.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody now is going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, Gone with the Wind. And they did not want to make an exception because, as we all know, exceptions are used as an example. So. But somehow or other, he got around it. He had to pay a fine. I can't recall now. I think it was $5,000 or something like that. A fine to show that, you know, that, hey, we're letting you do it, but you're not entirely off the hook. And it did, over the years, introduce more, but it wasn't something that happened on every picture right away.
My guest is Rudy Belmer, editor of the book Memo from David O. Selznick. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rudy Belmer, and in 1972, he edited a book of David O. Selznick's memos, and that book, Memo from David O. Selznick, has just been published in a new edition in a new series of film books edited and chosen by Martin Scorsese. Now, one of Selznick's claims to fame is that he basically brought Alfred Hitchcock to America from England and launched his American film career. What was their working relationship like?
Well, it's very interesting because Hitchcock had, of course, been directing in England for years and had been very successful, and some of his pictures had international fame, which wasn't always the case, of course, with British films. And he brought him over to do Rebecca. And, of course, Hitchcock was most anxious to come here because this is where it was all happening in Hollywood at that time. And, of course, the resources were much greater, and all of the things that you had to work with and the distribution and what have you. So he was delighted. Selznick and Hitchcock both respected each other, and Selznick let Hitchcock alone more than he did other directors. But he was very much involved still with the script, with the casting, the pre-production, that is, Selznick was on a Hitchcock film. But he usually let Hitchcock alone during shooting. But then Selznick became heavily involved again in post-production and editing and scoring and so forth. Now, for a while, this worked out all right. But as usual, and as is the case as time went by, Hitchcock wanted more freedom. And he was not thrilled with the overzealous Selznick, and Selznick, of course, became more and more and more involved in things as the years went by. And Hitchcock, of course, had established a name. It was Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock's this, that, and the other thing, where he became one of the best known of directors to the public at large. Most people in those days didn't know the directors. You know, they knew Cecil B. DeMille, Frank Capra, and Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right.
Really, that's about it. And before that, D.W. Griffith. But beyond that, nobody was really interested in the director's credit. And it certainly wasn't going to be above the title. But you had Alfred Hitchcock's blah, 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 Spellbound. Now, Selznick was very, very shrewd. He orchestrated this. But you see, he created a Frankenstein in a sense that, you know, then Hitchcock wanted out, as so many of the people who worked with Selznick over the years wanted out eventually, because they could do very well elsewhere and achieve independence.
You've collected Selznick's memos in this book, and it seems to me one of the reasons why he must have written memos is that if you're delivering somebody your wishes in a memo, they can't talk back to you. They can't say, no, I won't do that because you're wrong because. They have to read it, and then they're expected to just act on it. Did
That's
people
right.
talk back to him afterwards? Do you know?
Well, of course, I'm sure there were a lot of irate people who would get these long-winded memos and criticizing something, and they would call him up on the phone, or they would go down to his office or what have you. In some cases, I think they were just thunderstruck and didn't say anything. And in other cases, they were hired hands. So they thought, oh, okay, I'll swallow my pride and go do what he wants. Also, of course, there were answers to some of these memos. Now, in the book, as you know, Terry, it's all Selznick's memos because, of course, the person who writes a piece of material, whether it's a letter or whatever, is the legal owner of it, even though somebody else has received it. So this is the Selznick version, because otherwise I'd have to get clearance from 9 million people to put their answers in there. But again, for the most part, there were not a lot of answers in the files. There were a lot of, references to things, but not long-winded retorts.
Did Selznick really write a memo saying that his funeral service should be simple and brief so that no one would be bored?
Yes, he wrote. That's right. And they followed that. They followed that dictum. And he was always afraid of people being bored, because he had a threshold of boredom, and he just wanted to move things along. Also, you know, he was addicted to Benzedrine, and this is before the days when people knew exactly what harm it could do. So that's why he was working, you know, like 21 hours a day and expecting everybody else to be fresh at 8 o'clock in the morning and at midnight.
Huh. Well, Rudy Belmer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure once again, particularly going back to 1971 and 2.
Rudy Belmer edited the book Memo from David O. Selznick, which has just been republished as part of a series of republications of classic movie books. The series editor is Martin Scorsese.